The gun debate intensifies as Florida legislatures look at a measure that would allow weapons on university campuses. We'll take your calls just ahead. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. And just ahead, we want you to join the conversation on Florida's so-called campus carry bill. What's your opinion on concealed weapons on college and university campuses in the Sunshine State? Get on the line now, 549-2937. Then later, helping people on the First Coast with a disability find work. We'll tell you about three events this month marking National Disabilities Awareness Month. Plus, Culpepper on the Jags' heartbreaker in Indy. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, the fatal shooting of at least seven people at an Oregon community college. Now yet another example of a school shooting that both supporters and opponents of proposed campus carry legislation in Florida are going to point to when they make their case. The legislature in our state is considering measures that would allow people with concealed weapon permits to bring their firearms on public college and university campuses. Senate Bill 68 and House Bill 4001 have each passed a committee in their respective chambers, largely along party lines. And opinions are heated on both sides as we look at this. And joining us now in studio, we welcome a panel to discuss it all. Eric Friday, lead attorney for the gun rights group Florida Carry, joining us. Good morning.
Morning.
John White is president of the UNF chapter of United Faculty of Florida, opposing the measure. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Adam White is a University of Central Florida student who has testified before the state legislature about this. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning.
And the lines are already jamming up as we discuss this. The number is 549-2937, but I don't think anyone's going to be able to get through for a while. Why don't you email or tweet the show at wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect or weigh in on our Facebook page. You know, it's interesting, John. We had actually booked this segment with both you and Eric Friday several weeks ago, and then the shooting happened in Oregon, which lends added urgency to the debate for people that stand on both sides of this contentious conversation in America. Let's begin with your side. How will your United Faculty of Florida organization point to the shooting in Oregon to argue against the measure?
Well, one of the things we want to remind everyone of is that campus shootings, despite the fact they are a terrible tragedy, are very rare. Campuses are notoriously safe places, almost always remarkably safer than the communities in which they're a part. We don't think that more guns are going to make campuses safer than they already are. We think that this tragedy is, I don't know how we could have stopped it, but I don't think that any armed students on campus would have stopped it. Matter of fact, there, from recent reports have shown that there were students with concealed weapons on campus, and they were not able to stop the shooting. So I don't think that more guns in the hands of more people makes the situation any better.
Eric Friday, after the shooting, the president of the United States, Barack Obama, said he doesn't understand how more guns can make people safer. However, you were quoted as saying that there were, is a law in Oregon that already allows concealed weapons on college campuses and that having a rule prohibiting guns on campus wouldn't have stopped this killer.
Well, first of all, Oregon, actually, the law there is that while guns are allowed on campus, the university and the colleges have banned them from all buildings. So the students that were actually in the room weren't allowed to, including the Army combat vet who was in the room. He wasn't allowed to have his weapon either. Secondly, these incidents, allowing concealed carry on campus isn't about running after the shooter. It's about if you are in the shooter's area when he starts, you should be able to defend yourself. You shouldn't have to wait however long it takes for the police to get there and just be defenseless for that time.
Adam Whitmer, you're a University of Central Florida student. You testified about this in Tallahassee. You're against it. Why?
John said before, I don't think that more guns makes people safer. When I was in the Marines, I was a marksmanship instructor and competition shooter. I've trained a lot of people when it comes to handgun usage. And I don't think that in a chaotic environment that more guns makes any situation any more safe for anyone.
Eric Friday, what about that argument?
Well, if you want to know the response to it, look at the Clackamas Mall shooting. Look at Pearl, Mississippi. Look at the Appalachian State Law School shooting. In each one of those cases, a person with a gun stopped the shooter, either because the shooter decided to self-terminate once they were confronted by armed response or because the shooter decided to stop.
John White.
Well, there are plenty of examples, including one that I've just put up on our website, that, for instance, done by 2020 a number of years ago, that showed what happens when students are armed in the classroom and someone unexpected bursts into the classroom. The vast majority of people who have a gun on them, as my colleague Adam said, are not prepared to use it in an emergency situation, even to defend themselves. More often than not, the victim is the person carrying the gun. In other words, the gun is more often used against a victim than to protect that victim.
There are so many calls on this that I'm going to open the phones a little earlier than normal, just so we can get a wide range of opinions. Let's go to your calls right now at 549-2937. Chris in Ponte Vedra. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I think that there are some good things and some bad things that could come from not allowing students to have guns on campus, but I really believe that where the problem lies is the enforcement of the existing laws that we currently have. Rather than limit the rights of the community, why don't we just enforce the current law? You can rob a bank 3 times at gunpoint before you get a life sentence. So I think that if we make the punishment for these types of crimes more harsh, then I think we'll have fewer of these crimes being committed. I mean, the reason that people have such harsh laws in other countries with regards to, children walking the streets at night is because the punishment for those types of heinous crimes is the death penalty. And so, therefore, they don't have that problem. So I think rather than to limit, the people by instilling new laws, that we just enforce the ones that we currently have.
Chris, thanks for the call. Eric Friday, that argument has come out a lot in recent days. At the same time, others have said mass shootings are a different type of situation. In virtually all of them, the perpetrator clearly had mental health issues and was able to easily, legally acquire weapons that they shouldn't have had access to. What are your thoughts on that? Well,
first of all, most of these cases are undiagnosed mental health issues. So every background check policy that's been proposed, every change in the law that's been proposed by the president would not have stopped any of these shootings. It is nothing more than not letting a crisis go to waste.
Adam.
I agree. I think that there needs to be less of a stigma when it comes to mental health. That's one of the major issues. A lot of people who are depressed or have mental issues are afraid to tell anybody. And that is one of the conversations that we need to have, as well as this one. And to respond to a point that you mentioned earlier about when you laid out a number of cases where a potential shooting was brought down by somebody with a gun, I'd be interested to see the training standards in those states, because part of the reason that I was brought on in Florida is because of the very lax standards that we've had over a number of years in Florida when it comes to getting a concealed carry permit.
You think there should be more stringent standards?
Well, a 2008 report by the Orlando Sentinel found that some people were able to use BB guns when it came to just learning how to pull a trigger. And at the League of Women Voters Conference, one of the members stood up and said that they were at a gun show and somebody just had to fire a BB gun at a piece of carpet and then pull a trigger with a blank.
Let's go to Al in Jacksonville. Go ahead, Al. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. First of all, I just want to address, we're always reactive and never proactive. And I don't know if you're aware of it or not, but formal law enforcement would probably be the best answer, allowing formal law enforcement to carry on campuses. You can't put it in the hands of the students. The students, like they say, if something happens, we just get frantic and, things just go all haywire. But if you put, start allowing former law enforcement to carry on campus, just like the air marshals. Nobody would know who they were unless they're out there publicizing it. But I think that would be a start instead of thinking about arming students. I mean, we have to look at this thing logically. First of all, students aren't trained. Former law enforcement, they are trained and have received training. And if they possess the actual permit to carry in all 50 states concealed, they have to have training every year to keep that updated. And I think that would be more of a logical way to approach this instead of going, off on a tangent with arming students on the campus.
Al, thank you. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there, Al. John White, that's your argument that students are too young and emotionally volatile, you say, to be allowed to bring weapons to class.
I do. Now, they would have to be 21 or older, but we also know from plenty of research that 21-year-olds do not have a fully developed prefrontal cortex, meaning their impulse control is not as strong as it would be for an adult. The caller is right, though, that universities and college campuses should have better protection in many cases. However, the universities, the state university system does have a very good protection system in that, for instance, at UNF, every one of our police officers on campus are former Jacksonville Sheriff's officers. They are armed, they are trained, and they have ongoing gun and tactical experience.
Eric Friday.
It sounds great when you're talking about the universities that all have their own police departments, but it doesn't sound so good when you talk about our numerous state college campuses, only five of which have armed police officers on campus. And the average age of those students, Melissa, is 29 years old. That's according to one of the opponents of this bill who spoke at the last legislative hearing. We're not talking about children. We're not talking about 16 and 15-year-olds. We're talking, or even 23, 24-year-olds. We're talking about 29-year-olds as the average age that we're dealing with here.
An interesting correlation to that, though, is, for instance, Valencia College. They have estimated between $4 and $6 million just to implement campus police for if this law passes. The state college system is estimated between $40 and $65 million will have to be spent just to prepare the campuses by arming the police, having them have vests and extra training if this law goes through.
Melissa, that's the most absurd argument that we've heard in this whole thing. The idea is because we have a rule now that says no guns on campus, we don't need a police department. But if we let law-abiding license holders who are actually more law-abiding on average than police themselves carry on campus, all of a sudden we're going to need armed law enforcement? That's ridiculous.
What about the pushback that you're getting, Eric, as a representative for Florida Carry from university presidents all over the state, including the former Speaker of the House, John Thrasher, bucking his party, saying, no, this is not a good idea for Florida State?
Well, Senator Thrasher, or President Thrasher now, is an interesting case because he's flip-flopped on this issue four times, kind of like John Kerry. He voted for it before he voted against it. When he was running for office, he was all in favor of campus carry. When he filled out questionnaires for the United Sportsmen of Florida and NRA, he was in support of campus carry. It's only later when he experienced a personal tragedy that he suddenly became an opponent and then flip-flop again after that.
Let's talk about that personal tragedy. The personal tragedy was one of his daughter's best friends was killed in her sight by a handgun at a party where people were using alcohol. They saw firsthand what happens when there's ready access to guns and alcohol. That's why John Thrasher changed his opinion.
Well, let's go back to some more of your calls. Fred at the Beaches. Go ahead, Fred.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call. I'm a student at a university here in Florida, and a real quick question to you is, I heard one of the gentlemen, I think, say that the prefrontal cortex isn't fully developed. Well, I've been serving the Marine Corps since 2010, now in the reserves, and I can remember early 20s and my 19th and 18th birthday being a lot different than the average student. So I think that if you would let veterans carry concealed, I think things would get a lot better because veterans, especially deployed, have a lot more experience than, you know, we're used to hearing calamity and we can do a lot better under pressure than everybody, you know, anything else. So I think if you allow, you know, veterans to carry and concealed, look at most of the veterans are stopping these mass shootings. The guys are running towards the gun hellfire because we put the community first. We don't worry about ourselves. We just want the chance to protect, and we carry that creed with us the entire time, even when we're out.
Thank you, Fred. Thank you. Adam Whitmer, you're a veteran, and it's my understanding that actually a veteran on the Oregon Community College campus tried to stop that shooter. What about that caller's point?
I would say that being a veteran is separate from brain development. I mean, if that's his major argument against it. Like I said, I was a marksmanship instructor for roughly 2.5 years. I taught hundreds of Marines of all ages, both genders, and my biggest issue with this is the lack of training standards. A couple people have asked me if my position would change if the training standards were different, and you know, I can't say for sure, but right now they are lacking.
Johnny on the north side, go ahead, Johnny. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm going to try to keep this kind of short. As a witness and a victim of gun violence, we always seem to come up with all these laws and proposed legislation. And it seems that all it does is hurt the the law-abiding citizens, because I am now a licensed carrier. And one thing that we fail to notice is criminals do not care about laws or legislation, and we can't legislate criminality or craziness. And that's it.
Johnny, thanks. Let's get a few more of you on the air. Then we'll go to your emails and tweets. PJ on the West Side this morning. Hi, PJ. What are your thoughts?
Hey, I just want to say that I think that this open carry is, it's a prudent, well-thought-out decision because, you know, when you have a shooter roaming on campus from building to building, and if you can throw in a football player and an accounting student and let's add in a cafeteria worker, too, with a handgun, you know, I think that the campus police are going to breathe a sigh of relief in law enforcement when they come on campus and they have, you know, four or five extra people going around with guns on campus. And I'll take your thoughts off the air. Thank you.
PJ, thank you. John, you're shaking your head.
That's just not correct. That's why the state police, or I mean, the police for the campuses and the state college system have all come out against it unanimously. The union for the police has come out against it. They think it's a terrible idea. One of their concerns is if there is an active shooter on campus, when the police show up, if there's a melee going on and there's two or three or four shooters, the police can't even differentiate who the bad guy is.
Eric.
First of all, Melissa, this is the same argument that we heard in 1987 when Florida passed concealed carry. Oh my gosh, there's going to be all these problems. The police aren't going to know who are the good guys. The fact is, none of those concerns, none of those parade of horribles happened. The college campus police chiefs are doing nothing but echoing the same mistakes of police officers from 1987. They're just as wrong. They're just as incorrect. And if they aren't able to tell the difference between a good guy and a bad guy when they respond to a situation, then they aren't appropriately trained.
Here's a follow-up question from Linda, and this is directed to you, Eric. Who's going to provide liability coverage for the innocent person shot on the college campus by the student? Will that person have to carry a $5 million umbrella policy? Won't the college get sued? What about the state? What about liability and parents saying, I'm not going to send my child to a college that allows this?
Fine, let's talk about liability. Right now, the colleges have zero liability for the innocent, disarmed individuals on their campus. Secondly, people carry in the community every day, in the grocery store, in the parks. People who are licensed to carry guns have them beside you every day. And they don't have to carry liability insurance for that. And they're the most law-abiding segment of Floridians that we can identify.
Adam.
Actually, according to the Gun Violence Archive, as of, I believe, Friday, there have been 902 instances of defensive gun usage, while there have also been 1,390 accidental shootings.
All right. Mitchell and Palatka. Go ahead, Mitchell.
Yes, I've been thinking for quite a long time the solution to this problem, because guns by themselves with no ammunition in them are no more dangerous than a steel pipe. But the way to stop these mass shootings is to make a law that requires that when you buy ammunition, you have to turn in the same number of empty shells that you want to buy. This means that a person could not be a beginner just coming into a gun store and buying a huge pile of ammunition and guns and going out and do something. And it would be a complication that would stop many deranged minds when they would find that, hey, I've got to get some empty shells before I can buy any full shells. You see what I mean?
All right, Mitchell, thanks for that. Let's go to Lisa in Riverside. Lisa, go ahead.
Well, first of all, I realized that there was actually a student on the campus in Oregon that had a concealed gun, and he said he was in no way prepared for what happened and therefore was not able to defend himself with that gun. But all you have to do is look at the Australia gun ban of 1996 when they had a mass shooting and outlawed guns after that, and they haven't had any severe mass shootings or gun crime in that country since 1996. So I think the answer obviously is not more guns. It's we need less guns and to strengthen the gun laws that we have. Thank you.
Thanks, Lisa. Let me get both of you to respond to that, John and Eric. In recent days, that's been brought up a lot, how other countries, in particular Australia, have responded with new laws. John and then Eric.
One of my best friends is Australian, and I knew about this many years ago. But I think Australia is a very different culture than we have here. I don't think that there's going to be any mass turn-in of guns. And actually, I'm not here to fight the Second Amendment. That's for a different show and a different argument. But I'm here to say that campuses should be a place that, at least on an individual campus level, should be able to choose whether or not students have guns. One of the corollary issues we haven't talked about is the silencing effect or the censoring effect that possibly armed students in the classroom would have. And as a professor, I know firsthand about this. We challenge students. We expose them to new ideas. And in many cases, students are upset by those ideas. Anyone who's ever seen a student who's gotten a bad grade and comes to the professor to complain about it knows how angry and heated it could get. You add guns to that mix, and my colleagues and I are very fearful, and our students have mentioned they're fearful as well, that someone in that classroom may be armed. And it does have a silencing effect. It's deleterious on open discourse.
Eric.
There are no security measures on our campus. There is nothing that keeps a gun from coming onto these campuses. We are talking about people who have guns, who lawfully carry them, but all of a sudden, because they get a bad grade, they don't bring them onto campus and use them against the teacher. But all of a sudden, if we allow them to lawfully be on campus, they're going to start using them against the professors? That makes no sense, Melissa. It's nothing but an emotional argument to a logical problem.
Well, Eric, next time you come to my classroom and teach some classes, then you can speak from experience.
These two pieces of legislation are moving through the process. Both of you your organizations will be lobbying, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So where does it stand?
Right now, it's got several more committees in each house to go through. Each committee will vote on it, and if it goes like last year, there will be bipartisan support for these bills.
And Adam, are students still making their voice heard in the process? There's also, we should point out, a student group that's in favor of it.
There are. And honestly, more students need to get their voices heard in the political system. The people my age, a lot of the times, don't think that the politicians really care about them, for or against. That's regardless. If this helps more people get involved in their political system, especially on a local level, I'm all for that.
All right.
The bill is not passing through the houses or the subcommittees with bipartisan support. It's passing by people who are very highly correlated with a very high NRA rating.
Well, we thank you all in the meantime for joining us, gentlemen. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa.
We were joined by Eric Friday, lead attorney for the gun rights group Florida Carry. John White is president of the UNF chapter of United Faculty of Florida. Adam White is a UCF student. And next week, One Jacks Institute presents the next program in its civil discourse series, Gun Control, a Loaded Topic. That's Monday, October 12th at 7 p.m. at the UNF Fine Arts Center, Lazara Performance Hall. A panel discussion with diverse perspectives on the topic, moderated by UNF President John Delaney. That is free and open to the public a week from tonight. Well, much more still to come later. Cole Pepper on the Jags' heartbreaking loss in Indy. But up next, helping people on the First Coast with a disability find employment. We'll tell you how. Back in a moment.
WJZT, the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville, and Grassroots Natural Market are accepting submissions from local artists for The Square. The Square is an online venue where artists share their work with the community and compete for a chance to be featured on WJZT-TV and radio. Submit now through November 30th. To learn more about The Square and to submit your work, visit wjct.org/thesquare.
Looking at a hospital bill can make one's brain hurt because one can't figure out where one's money is going.
Some of the things we really did need to cost out, like what does it cost for every minute in the operating room, every minute in the ER, every minute in the MRI scanner, for example.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. How one team broke down the cost of a doctor's visit. Next time on Marketplace from APM.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
On the next episode of WJCT's Hometown, explore Jackson's Night Market, sample the Candy Apple Cafe, get to know the volunteers in medicine, look back with the First Presbyterian Church of Jacksonville, and commune with the Jesse Ball DuPont Center. WJCT's Hometown, Thursday night at 8 on WJCT Public Television.
Excuse me, sit down. You weren't called. Sit down. Sit down. Sit down.
Donald Trump's confrontation with Univision news anchor Jorge Ramos was many Americans' introduction to the Mexican-born journalist. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk with Ramos about his conflict with Trump, his life, and working as an immigrant journalist in the U.S. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, October is National Disability Employment Awareness Month, a time to celebrate the many and varied contributions of America's workers with disabilities. This year is the 70th anniversary of that Awareness Month and the 25th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Now, three big events are coming up for people in our area with disabilities who are looking for work. And here to tell us more, we welcome Carrie Haynes with Opportunity Services. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you doing?
I'm great, thanks. Thanks for being with us. And we're so excited to share this news because this Friday, October 9th, an employment expo coming up at the downtown campus of FSCJ. What's going to be happening?
So there are a couple different things that we are going to have happen over at this event at the Employment Expo. And we are going to be going over different topics that include self-advocacy in the workplace, dressing for success, interviewing, work incentives, financial empowerment, and more things as well. So there will be Agency for Persons with Disabilities, APD, Division of Blind Services, which is DBS, Vocational Rehabilitation, the ARC, ILRC, City of Jacksonville, Career Source that will have the their computer lab there to assist as well for applying for jobs.
And you're going to be coordinating all of these different nonprofits and agencies together in one place to help people with, it sounds like, a whole different range of disabilities.
Correct.
We're talking people that are blind. What other types of disabilities?
It ranges from anything from mental to physical. So any type of disability. So the community is definitely welcome to join this event as well, to receive more information regarding the different agencies that are here in this community to assist them.
It's hard enough for people without a disability sometimes to find a good job. If you have a disability, it can be so difficult. So this assistance, this employment assistance is vital, isn't it?
It is. And that's what we're trying to do, is we're trying to break down a lot of these barriers to help people with being successful in finding employment, and also speaking with employers and trying to get employers involved here in Jacksonville.
And that's a big part of the process too, isn't it, Carrie? Educating employers that a person with a disability is a great employee. They're so appreciative to have the job. They have an excellent work ethic, and they want to be a valued contributor and team member.
Correct. And reliable, too, as well. And throughout the month of October, what we're looking for as well is for employers to get involved and sign up for the mentor, to become a mentor for an individual with a disability so that they can come into the workplace and have the opportunity to see exactly their work ethic, their dedication, you know, how they can be a great worker for the workplace to give somebody an opportunity.
How can employers get in touch to do that, to get involved?
So the way that they can find out more information or to get involved is they can contact me over at Opportunity Services, and my phone number is 904-524-0104, or respond through email at carrieh@opserv.org.
Carrieh@opserv.org. And not only will you be holding various disability mentoring day events at various companies throughout October, which is National Disability Employment Awareness Month. This is all culminating in a Human Resources Symposium and Hiring Abilities Job Fair coming up November 2nd at Florida Blue. So that's another major First Coast employer that's getting involved, which is so exciting.
I know. Yes, the city of Jacksonville is getting involved in Florida Blue. They are definitely great with hosting a lot of the events that are held here. And this is the, like I said, this is the third time that they've done this type of event here in Jacksonville. So we're excited to definitely be involved in this as well. And a big part of the October 9th event for the Employment Expo is to prepare individuals for the November 2nd event so that when they're going through the job fair, they're prepared for the interview and they're prepared to speak with employers.
And who's the guest speaker? There's a pretty good keynote. Is that right?
Over at for the symposium, correct?
Uh-huh.
Okay, for the Job Accommodation Network.
Right. Now, it's been 25 years since the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act. In that quarter century, would you say that we've made decent progress when it comes to Americans with disabilities in the workplace?
Yes, I definitely believe that there has been a lot of progress as far as the awareness and, you know, employing and breaking down those barriers, and we are still trying to do that today. But yes, it has, they've come a long way. We are able to, we definitely have, you know, a lot of success stories. I know last year we did an article with you know, the news press where they outlined an individual that has been successful in employment for over a year, and it definitely shows the dedication. So yes, I believe that it has come a long ways as far as, you know, employing people, and we're still working on that today.
And you can be part of it this Friday, October 9th, at the Employment Expo at the downtown campus of Florida State College at Jacksonville. If you have a disability and need a job, you need to be there. If you're an employer and you want to be involved in mentoring someone with a disability, you need to get in touch with Carrie. Again, it's carriehatch@opserve.org. Did I get that right?
Yes, you did.
Carrie Haynes with Opportunity Services. A pleasure. Again, it is National Disability Employment Awareness Month, so reach out and mentor someone, get educated, celebrate the 25th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. And thanks for being with us, Carrie.
Thank you.
We're back in a moment.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.
Stay connected. Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
In El Salvador, violent gangs control the streets, and they sometimes target teenage girls.
Her mom says the girl left at 3:30 in the afternoon, and then it was 4, and then it was 5, and we haven't heard from her since.
The danger of being a teenage girl in El Salvador, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Weekdays at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Life has enough drama.
I'm pinned under a log. It's across my legs.
Well, you know, we don't have big logs out here. This is the prairie, for crying out loud.
And reality.
Okay, we have ricotta biscotti and the Pavarotti and the summa cum laude.
No, find a way to forget your troubles.
So you know what, honey? I want you to freeze me.
What? And gather some friends around the radio this weekend.
A Prairie Home Companion, returning to WJCT this Saturday at 6.
Welcome back. Well, the First Coast Connect Book Club returns later this month with a discussion of writer David McCullough's biography of the Wright brothers. You can check out copies of the book from our partner, the Jacksonville Public Library, or our other partners, Chamberlain's or the Bookmine, where you can buy the book. And then send us your thoughts about the Wright brothers to bookclub@wjct.org. Here's our question for you. What are your memories of your first flight? Were they good or bad? We want to know. We'll share them on the air during our book club segment. Find out more about the book club at wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Well, in this city and around the country, animal shelters have the goal of being no kill. That is, they try to not ever euthanize any of the pets in their care. After a Delaware animal shelter euthanized 19 dogs just before it closed due to financial problems, a local artist decided to paint portraits of the thousands of dogs that are put down every year at shelters across this country. Those paintings have developed into an exhibit and even an upcoming PBS documentary. Here to tell us more about An Act of Dog, we welcome artist Mark Barone. Good morning.
Good morning.
His partner, Marina Durbin. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And on the line from Boston, filmmaker Bonnie Silva. Her company, Saga City Productions, is producing the film, An Act of Dog. Good morning, Bonnie, to you.
Good morning, Melissa.
Thanks for being with us, all three of you. So, Mark, this began when you heard about a shelter in Delaware that was no kill, but it ended up euthanizing some dogs.
Well, we did paint those 19 portraits, but Marina kind of give you a background of how it all started and how we got into it.
Yes, it was just, you know, Mark had his dog of 21 years, and it was about 6 months after that that we were looking to adopt another dog. That was all we were doing, was looking to adopt another dog. And instead of finding a dog, what I found out was what was going on across the country, you know, the numbers of animals that were being killed in shelters. And I was, you know, outraged by it and saddened. And so I gave the information to Mark. And him, being an artist, he saw a way of bringing those numbers to, you know, bringing faces and names and using art as a way for social change to help save the animals.
So you ended up painting thousands of portraits, quite an undertaking.
Yeah, 5,500.
And how did you get the images of the dogs and then get them onto canvas?
We had a lot of images from the rescues that tried to pull them out of the shelters unsuccessfully, and they got very close to a lot of these animals, and it was a way of memorializing them and also helping to try to, with their images, to help save the others. And so we had a lot of people from around the country. We had more than enough images to paint.
And it became, from that project, it evolved into an actual exhibit, is that right?
That's the end goal, yes.
That's the goal.
Yeah, there's, you know, to actually have all the paintings up and, you know, create a museum of compassion as a way to educate and help cultivate more compassion, as well as continue to raise funds for all of the animal welfare groups across the nation.
And Bonnie Silva on the line from Boston, not only will this hopefully become an exhibit, but also a PBS documentary. Tell us about An Act of Dog.
Yes, I am thrilled to be working on the project. And I have to say that it's something that really gripped me. From the first time I saw one of the dogs online, I didn't know at the time what the portrait was all about, what the project was that was attached to it. I didn't know the story behind it. So I explored it and decided to really take it on as a passion. And I have to say that there's something that Mark said to me during this project that really says something about how I felt the first time I saw one of these dogs' portraits online. He said, "These dogs that I painted, the images that I had, there's a lot of emotion that's got up in there that I have to be able to pull out. I know their fate because their fate had already been determined, so I had to get my mind into what their world was." I painted the 5,500 images so people would have to confront them. And I have to say that that's been, as a filmmaker, the toughest part for me is to convince people to actually take the first look and consider supporting this project and being a part of it in other ways.
Now, did you move to Jacksonville in part because this is a city that's committed to becoming a no-kill city, all of the different animal care groups?
Yeah, we definitely thought that Jacksonville had a lot of its game down when it comes to the animals, and certainly so many wonderful groups here working hard towards the no-kill goal. So we're still exploring.
And when can we hopefully see the film and hopefully the exhibit? Are you still raising money, Mark, to try to complete both?
The production of it we've finished, and now we are looking for people that will help support us in getting the permanent exhibition up, because what people don't understand is the exhibition itself. I mean, because I painted all of these on panel, weighs about 6 to 8 tons. I mean, it is a huge exhibition. If I hung them 10 feet high, they would go 2 football fields long. Not that that's how we would hang the exhibition, but people have to understand this is larger than the Sistine Chapel when I painted it. And so I have cashed in all of my retirement savings. It's gone, and that's what we use to fund this project.
Wow, this really is a labor of love, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And so we're looking for other people that have that same kind of passion and connection with what we're doing, and that really do believe that art can change things. Because I think people talk all the time about how many animals are killed every day or every year in this country, but there is not faces with them. And it is different when you have to actually confront the 5,500 images than just talking about numbers. And that is a different deal.
And Bonnie, the images are powerful, the film as well. What's the timetable for the documentary?
You know, we have done a lot of work on this project and are still raising funds to complete it. Ideally, we would love to complete it in 2016. We would just love to have the chance to share with people out there, what does it really mean to abandon comfort for adventure and trade your retirement savings for a life well lived and give up everything for this chance to follow your heart? And I'm hoping that people will be really inspired to either step up to do something with regard to this particular social problem, or if they're instead inspired by Mark and Marina's courage and stick-to-itiveness to move forward with their own project, that would be equally wonderful.
Well, there are a lot of animal lovers in this area, so I have confidence that someone listening is going to follow up. In the meantime, we thank you so much for being with us today. Thanks
you,
for
Melissa.
Sharing this with our listeners.
Thank you for
Thanks
having
for
us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Thank you, Melissa.
He's artist Mark Barone, also with us, his partner Marina Dervin, and on the line from Boston, filmmaker Bonnie Silva. It's An Active Dog and the To Be Determined Museum of Compassion. Go to the website anactivedog.org to learn more about it. We're back in a moment with Cole Pepper as the Jags break hearts in Indianapolis.
The PBS Fall Arts Festival, airing Friday nights on WJCT, is celebrating its 5th season of bringing audiences the best in arts programming. This season includes Unity, the Latin tribute to Michael Jackson, and Danny Elfman's music from the films of Tim Burton. WJCT will host live performances from Atlantic Beach Experimental Theater and Players by the Sea on the main stage of Hemming Park during the 3rd annual Oktoberfest Downtown Art Walk on Wednesday, October 7, beginning at 5 p.m.
Relax Radio is the great American songbook, oldies and light jazz.
The thing that's cool for me is that it feels like it's the music of my life.
Relax Radio is the station you can listen to all day on your HD radio.
Make a $120 gift to WJCT and you'll receive an HD radio so you can tune in to relax. Call 904-353-9528 for more information.
Follow what's happening at WJCT even when you're away from your radio. You can follow WJCT on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can listen live online to WJCT FM at wjct.org/listen or on iTunes Radio or TuneIn Radio. And you can hear all of your favorite WJCT FM shows anytime on demand on iTunes and Stitcher. Wherever you are, WJCT is there.
This is Watch Officer Miller Norton with the Duval County Emergency Preparedness Division. Disasters can strike with little to no notice. Create your disaster kit now, including water, non-perishable food, batteries, flashlight, weather radio, and important documents. Visit jacksready.com for more information and tune to 89.9, the designated emergency broadcaster for Northeast Florida.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, a heartbreaker for the Jaguars in Indy.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Culpepper is here now with the disappointing news. Gosh darn it.
Can I take people behind the scenes a little bit?
Yes,
here?
Please.
You know, as we prepare for this show, I prepare on Sunday nights and send you some notes of here's what I want to talk about. I give you the one line that the kind of lead-in line,
uh-huh.
And I just feel like a heartbreaker for the Jags in fill-in-the-blank city has been used
right.
so many times
right.
over the last two or three years, and we've been doing this, and it's I think we may have reached a tipping point. We'll talk about that in a second. The Jaguars went to Indy and didn't have to face the Colts quarterback Andrew Luck, who didn't play with a shoulder injury. Instead, it was 40-year-old Matt Hasselbeck. Not that 40 is old. In the NFL,
not.
Though, it is. And
that's not Elizabeth Hasselbeck's husband, is it? That's her, like her brother-in-law or something.
Brother-in-law,
yeah.
Yeah. And the thing was, the Jaguars couldn't beat him. They had the chance to win the game twice with field goals, but Jason Myers, the first-year kicker, missed. First, it was a 53-yarder at the end of the regulation, and then in overtime, pulling a 48-yard attempt wide to the left. When given the chance, 42-year-old Colts kicker Adam Vinatieri, sensing a theme here, didn't miss, booting the Colts to their record-tying 15th consecutive divisional win, a 16-13 Indy win in overtime.
So the old guys triumphed,
yes.
is what you're telling me.
Yeah, which, you know, I can get behind in some regard.
Exactly.
In this regard.
Sad for the home team, though.
But this is why it was particularly tough for the Jaguars and Jaguars fans who have endured a lot of tough losses through the years. This was the kind of game that a team that was taking the next step should win. Even though it was on the road, Indy wasn't playing well. They were without their starting quarterback, and they were vulnerable. Good teams almost always win these kind of games, and average teams usually win these kind of games. The Jaguars right now are in a struggle to become average, which, you know, is okay because they're young, better to be young and average. Young and average can get better, but the concern is that while they are better in some spots than they were a year ago, Blake Bortles is a clear example of this. He's playing better at quarterback. They are not better in enough places. I also think that they haven't learned not to lose. To me, that's you know, a team with such a track record. You talk about learning to win, but first you have to learn not to lose, and that's just not part of this team's DNA right now.
It's so sad. What does that mean, though? How do you learn not to lose?
Well, you do things. You don't make bad mistakes. They had one drive in the game where they committed five penalties, and that was the only drive that the Colts scored a touchdown the entire game.
Mm.
All right, so that don't have those kind of mistakes. A penalty here, a penalty there, it's going to happen. But five penalties on the same drive is not a way to get it done. So with first place in the division on the line, although it's early, and we're only at a quarter post in the season now, the Jaguars are 1-3. You do that four times, and you're 4-12, and you're probably looking for a new coach, and you're still at the bottom of the standings. In fact, the website 538, the analytics website, came out
sure.
with the every week they come out with their predictions on based
and,
on the
and they're
the weeks.
Scarily accurate.
They are, and the Jaguars and Buccaneers are the bottom two teams in the NFL, which is interesting because those two teams will meet next week, and the Buccaneers have been installed as 3-point favorites already. So the following week against Houston, these are basically must-win games for the Jaguars if they want a chance at relevance this year. Good news is they should get some injured players back in the next couple of weeks, in particular defensive tackle Derek Marks and tight end Julius Thomas. If they can get back on the field, They could be the difference that the Jaguars have in losing this kind of game and winning these
kind
of close
games. Well, let's hope so. At least one Florida team did well. The Gators having their biggest victory in years.
Yeah, and may have found the guy they need in head coach Jim McElwain. 38-10, the upset of third-ranked Ole Miss in the Swamp on Saturday, and the win vaults Florida to number 11 in the top 25, second biggest move ever from 25 to 11. Gators are 5-0. They face Missouri on the road on Saturday.
Georgia, though, not having the kind of weekend they were hoping for.
No, beaten by Alabama 38-10. Georgia drops from 8th till 19th in the rankings, fell behind Florida in the SEC East standings. So if Florida beats Georgia here in Jacksonville on Halloween, Florida would certainly be in good shape to make the SEC championship game as SEC East champions. We still have a ways to go, but Gator fans have to be feeling pretty good this week.
That'll be a fun Halloween night game.
It should be, and it's impacting other things as well. And some high school games are being moved earlier in the week to Thursday instead of Friday that week. It's going to be a very festive football weekend in Jacksonville.
Yeah, FSU beating Wake Forest over the weekend, and the Armada heading into the final month of their inaugural season.
Yeah, it looked like they would be riding a winning streak at the start of October. They were leading 1-0 over Indy 11, another Jacksonville versus Indy matchup. The Armada, though, had a disputed red card pulled on defender Meshack Jerome, forcing Jacksonville to play down a man for the final half hour of the match. Indy got the equalizer, escaped with a 1-1 draw. This weekend, the Armada are on the road to face Carolina, but return home a week from Saturday to face FC Edmonton at Community First Park. Season concludes on November the 1st.
And last but not least, Cole, some high school football matchups to talk about.
Yeah, I just want to put a note here that it has been a particularly good season for high school football teams in Jacksonville, particularly the smaller classifications. Trinity Christian, University Christian, and Bowles are all number one in their classifications in the entire state. Raines is number two, behind only Bowles in 4A. And Bowles and Raines meet on October the 29th, likely to be one of the more anticipated high school games of the year.
Yeah, that's always a fun rivalry. Well, always good to see you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Melissa.
He's Cole Pepper. Follow him on Twitter at Cole Pepper. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. Next on Diane Rehm, another mass shooting, this time at a community college in Oregon, prompts new calls to change gun laws. A look at the realities of ending the cycle of gun violence in the U.S. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.